pedestrian.
The cab is meant to reflect all of WRT's listening audience. Members of underrepresented groups of all ages are encouraged to apply. WRT is an equal opportunity affirmative action organization.
Welcome to Radio Literature, Madison's weekly look at poetry, fiction, nonfiction, theater, and experimental writing for readers of all ages. Settle in for a half hour of conversation on radio literature. Here's your host, Melvin Hinton.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Radio Literature. Because it is Thursday at 7:30 Central Time here in Madison, Wisconsin. And we have a special guest, Charles Edward Payne. Are you known, do you prefer to be known professionally as Charles Payne or Charles Edward Payne?
Charles Payne is
Charles
fine.
Payne, okay. Mm-hmm. Charles Payne is a poet, a playwright, an essayist, a teacher, and I just found out today that he's a poet. I didn't even realize he was a poet until today, and I just found out he's other things as well, but maybe we'll go into that later. So, Charles Payne, well, I first discovered you, and I feel as if I have discovered a treasure in reading your essays on the back page of the last page of the Isthmus. I have a note here that says Charles Payne is a Wisconsin transplant. Where were you transplanted from?
I would say a little bit everywhere, but my family's from Detroit, Michigan. I was raised in Lansing, Michigan. Mm-hmm. I went to a directional school in Michigan. I went to Central Michigan, of course, and I got a teaching degree. And, of course, I couldn't find a teaching job in Michigan, so the best offer for me was in Phoenix, Arizona. So then I did some jumping around the Southwest before I made my way to Madison, Wisconsin. Mm,
yeah. Yeah, I saw something about Phoenix, and I thought, well, that's where he's from or where? Mm-hmm. And you said a directional school?
Yeah. So like Central, Northern, we call those directional schools. UW-Madison is like, the UW system is a lot different than schools across the other states. Mm-hmm. Usually, they don't have the same name. I didn't realize that until I lived here in Indiana, that the top university could have smaller institutions and they all feed into one system. So we had Central Michigan, Western Michigan, Northern Michigan, and Michigan. And then when I was in Arizona, we had Arizona State, Arizona, and Northern Arizona University. So I chose to do a master's at Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff, which is really near and dear to my heart. It's just a beautiful town.
So you were born and grew up in Detroit?
Grew up in Lansing, Michigan.
Oh, Lansing, Michigan. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then when did you leave there to go to college?
I left Lansing to go to college. I went to Central for it. It took me about 6 years to graduate.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And, well, you know, it took longer than that for Nikki Giovanni to graduate.
Yeah.
Because, not that she was slow, but she was expelled. And then she had to come back and several years later and finish her last 2 year junior and senior years. And that's why we graduated in the same class.
Wow.
Because she let, I think, about 3 years lapse before she came back. Mm-hmm. But I like to mention that. I like to say I was her first editor because I was the editor of the campus newspaper, I published one of her first pieces of writing, which was, even then, it was outstanding. Let's see. It also says here in my notes, you are a certified teacher. I'd never seen that phrase before. Mm-hmm. Is that's not like certified, government inspected pork or beef, is it? I imagine that's something different.
I put it because I have state licensure. That's really important to me.
Yeah.
Education's really changed. So a lot of people who are teaching now didn't go to school to become a teacher.
Hmm.
I've made it a note to make sure people know that I went to school to learn how to be the best teacher that I could be.
Mm. So when you got your master's in education, I believe.
Yes.
Did you get a job right away teaching?
So I went into higher education, and I worked in a field called student affairs. Mm-hmm. I worked as a residence hall director. Mm-hmm. I learned very early on I was not ready to be an adult. So when I found a job that could offer housing and I didn't have to worry about like my credit that I did not have or was used by someone else when I was younger, I had housing already covered in the work that I was doing. Uh-huh. So that was like the hardest part, I think, navigating my first year teaching was how can I find somewhere that I can afford to live?
Yeah.
You have to get your heat and electric cut on. That's all bad. You know, that's all harder than anticipated if you don't have someone who's guiding you on how to do that. So when I went back to get my master's, I had like a plan in place. I was going to get this master's in education and I was going to work as a hall director until I figured out what I really wanted to do.
And did you start teaching there in, that was in Phoenix?
Yep, I started teaching in Phoenix. It was the best year of my life.
Mm.
And I was, they called it rifting. I was laid off immediately. Because of the housing market crash. So a lot of like teachers who moved all the way down to Arizona without a job. So the only thing I really knew and had skills for was I knew I could get back into school.
Yeah.
So when I didn't have a teaching job, I went back up into the master's.
Okay. And then after that, what happened?
So I ended up like dabbling with teaching. I started to explore more. I wanted the experience of teaching in a charter school, which was nothing like I thought it was going to be.
Mm.
I've taught high school. I've taught a lot of mathematics because for some reason science isn't really a protected subject area. So if your test scores are low, your principal can say, you're a really great teacher. You're teaching math now. So I did a lot of exploring of different jobs, trying to figure out like where I can use my skill set for. A lot of my schools either were underfunded and closed or had something happen where it was just like, I can't stay here any longer. I need to find somewhere else where I can be more impactful.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I have an essay of yours here, which was published in Madison Magazine. And I found this very interesting because it reminded me of an experience I had one summer working in the Upward Bound program as a teacher.
Okay.
And as a student, I had worked as a counselor the initial programs. They were still experimental, mm-hmm. but the very first Upward Bound programs, and one was at Fisk University.
Okay.
And I worked in that the first two summers, and then I graduated. So it reminded me of that experience. It made me think of that experience. So I'm wondering if you would mind reading part of that essay and up to this point here.
Okay. Come celebrate with me that every day something has tried to kill me and has failed. Poet, educator, and writer Lucille Clifton. Celebrate. How old were you when you were first racially profiled by a cop? I was 16. I was a high school junior, captain of my varsity basketball team, when an officer decided to unfairly pull me over in front of my house. I don't say unfairly lightly, because if you've ridden in a car with me, you know I am the slowest driver ever. But before I could even attempt to pull out my license and registration for the officer, my mother ran out the house like a souped-up Dodge Charger. Out came the gun, up with my hands. The moment was tense. Then I remember my mom objecting to my outfit. I had on a tank top that I normally wore underneath my high school basketball jersey, and my mom was irate. She made me and the officer aware of his power. She told us that the officer could shoot me in the head in front of our house and no one would say a thing because of what I was wearing. And the officer agreed with her, told me to stop dressing like a thug and let me off with a warning. My mother made me wear polos wherever I left the house from then on, as if dressing like a preppy Flat Albert could disguise my big black body from the police. Surprisingly, I found myself with a master's degree and teaching at an expensive private school a decade later when a rent-a-cop security officer pulled his weapon on me in a print shop parking lot. His car's spotlight shined so bright on my face, I dropped my box of orientation packets and my active shooter training took over. I raised my hands and identified myself by pointing to the staff ID on my work polo, calling out calmly, I am blank, blank. I work for blank school. I'm a blanking teacher. There is no blanking danger in this area. My hands are up. You may approach. There's no need to sweep and secure the space. The security officer lowered his weapon and screamed back, this is private property. You do not belong here. He approached with his bright spotlight still burning my eyes, called me a transient, and then spit on the ground. I told him, no, I am a customer walking to their car. He smirked and then spit again. He did not apologize to me for pointing a gun at me, a customer. He never cut off his light. So at 9 o'clock that night, I swear to you, a piece of my humanity left my soul. I looked inside the store window to see a black worker wiping away a single tear running from his eye, only to realize I was staring at a reflection of myself in that window, wearing my mother's disguise of a school polo, khakis, and orthopedic walking shoes.
That was Charles Edward Payne, our guest here on Radio Literature tonight. Reading from an essay that of his that was published in Madison Magazine. So if you want the rest of the story, you can go to and read it in Madison Magazine. This is from 2022. Of course, this experience is not unique, unfortunately, but you bring it to life, and you speak for many people who would not have been able to write it up this evocatively. And I found it interesting in one of the notes, and again, a note I have here, you said, as a child, you loved hearing the sound of Paul Harvey's voice. Mm-hmm. Now, I discovered Paul Harvey much later as an adult. And I thought about it for a moment. I thought, well, we may have grown up in the same country geographically, but in probably every other respect, we grew up in different countries because we grew up in different times. So in Nashville, where I was, I'm sure if I'd known what station to turn to, I could have heard Paul Harvey's voice. But of course, we were listening to the so-called black stations, even though they were owned by white people. Mm-hmm. But everybody that you heard on the air was black. And all the programs, you know, we listened to rhythm and blues. And I mean, I never even listened to jazz on the radio until I, many years later, living in France and Spain. But... And I thought, well, later, if I had to choose, because I guess I must have discovered them around the same time, it was Paul Harvey and Alistair Cook. Did you ever listen to Alistair Cook, Letter from America? Did you ever get that one?
Never got that one.
No.
I was so into Paul Harvey, and I really got into Mitch Albom.
I know that name.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Really great writer, and I just became, like, obsessed with him. It was super interesting because the reason why I listened to so much talk radio is because we would travel so far for me to play sports. But I knew something was wrong because I look forward to hearing the radio more than I enjoyed actually playing the actual game. So I knew I had an interest in, you know, becoming a writer and learning how to, you know, make the most of this process.
Yeah.
Because I thought I just found it so engaging.
Yeah. Now, you know, when I was a child and just reading and hearing people, not that much because people didn't talk about poets where I was, except in English class at school. But there was this idea, I guess it's been around for a long time, maybe it was the reality as well at one point, that poets are bohemians. And I discovered today, as I said earlier today, that you are a poet in addition to all these other things. But from everything I'd read about you, I thought, well, he's certainly not bohemian. Had you encountered this idea that poets as bohemians?
No, I haven't encountered. I haven't encountered that idea. I've been very disrespected because I've liked poetry, and because I'm a spoken word artist for a very long time. People told me I was destroying the art form that is poetry.
Uh-huh.
I didn't get really access to classes until I moved here to Madison. And Arts and Literature Lab opened their doors to someone like me to learn. And they gave me access to the knowledge that I needed to finally get some of my work published. And if it wasn't for their teachers and the people who put this time into me, I don't think I have the play that's going to go up pretty soon. I definitely don't have these essays.
Yeah.
Shout out to Rita Mae. This was 100% their idea. They pushed me towards it. I accepted the challenge.
And I love Rita Mae.
Yeah.
Rita Mae Reese.
Man, just had such a huge impact on me at a time in my life where I was not, you know, where I was not found. I was very lost. I was not grounded. But I started to find myself becoming more and more grounded the more I wrote within those walls of Arts and Literature Lab.
Very interesting what you said, and I'm glad you said those words, because I was going to ask you about this term spoken word artist. I've never quite understood the usefulness of that. I mean, why a spoken word artist? What is a spoken word artist? Are actors a spoken word artist?
I mean, it's an artist, you know. Unfortunately, I'll never be just a poet. I'll be a black poet. And if I don't want to take the name as a black poet, then I'm a spoken word artist because what I do isn't considered just general art. So I think it's just coded language for people to book you to do shows of that nature.
Yeah.
I've heard people use it a lot, but I think it's the same as a poet, but it's unfortunately, when you are a poet of color, you're kind of put in a box, especially if you're a loud poet like me. I'm really loud. I'm a loud poet, so they definitely put you in that category, unfortunately.
Now, have you read Robert Hayden?
No, I haven't.
Really? Well, you have something wonderful to look forward to. I remember confronting, in quotes, a radio personality once who made a remark about Robert Hayden. And when I got a chance to meet her in person, I explained to her, because she thought he was standoffish. I explained to her that when I knew him, which was long before she knew him, he was already legally blind.
Wow.
So he wasn't standoffish. He just couldn't walk around like everybody else because he didn't know, you know, he would get lost. And so, you know, people had to go up to him because he couldn't. I mean, just think of any blind person. And, you know, they can't just walk along the street and see who, you know, who they run into. You have to meet them where they are. But anyway, I look forward to hearing your reaction to some of Robert Hayden's poetry. The Isthmus essay that I read is, of course, is not the one that you just read from, but there was another essay. I thought I had it here with me, but I guess I don't. But it was about a trip that you made to Washington, D.C. with of your students. You took a group of students to Washington, D.C., and I wondered how many students there were and whether you were the only chaperone.
I was not the only chaperone.
Okay. I can breathe a sigh of relief.
Yeah, there are two teachers there. Two teachers. Mr. Roper was there. He was like our team leader. He was an incredible teacher. Graphic designer was his background. But he was such an amazing instructor.
But I remember reading that and wondering and thinking, you must have had those children well trained.
Ooh, I don't know if I have them well trained. I think teaching in Phoenix, my students were a lot more mature.
Oh, okay.
And I think we had an understanding of what it meant to survive when you're different. So I want to say I had them well trained. I think I had them informed.
Well,
of the world around them. You know,
I guess that's the same thing. That's what I actually mean. I mean, mm-hmm. trained in that sense. They were informed of what the situation was and how they needed to act in order to survive mm-hmm. intact.
Well, and also you need to have if you've never done something before, like traveling through our airports has got to be extremely strange. I couldn't imagine. So I think the more you can prepare someone for, you know, that type of experience, the more successful they'll be. And then if you've never left Phoenix, I can tell you the Midwest and the East is a lot different than the Southwest.
Uh-huh.
The attitudes are a lot different. So
I mean, when
I think of East Coast and I think of like my experiences in Boston and D.C., I think it's a lot more aggressive than it is in the Southwest. I feel like the Southwest is very like laid back. So you gotta be prepared for the shifts of the dynamics of the spaces you're gonna be in, you mm-hmm. know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that essay showed, that like by having those conversations, there were no surprises on this trip.
And one thing that I understood, correct me if I got the wrong impression, that the majority of the Now, what ages were those? That's another.
So they're eighth grade students.
Eighth grade, okay. Mm-hmm. So I can still call them children.
Mm-hmm.
I got the impression that most of them were Hispanic or.
Yep, Latinx for sure.
Okay.
Yep, the majority of them were Latinx in all the schools that I taught in Phoenix, which was great for me. I mean, it was such a beautiful place to be. And because I was having trouble renting, I lived in the same neighborhood as my students, and I wish that was something more teachers would do. Because I really got immersed into the culture that was the school, and because of that I was able to accomplish some really great things there.
Well, we need to talk about the play that's coming up at Broome Street Theater starting April 19th at Broome Street Theater, which is on Williamson Street. You have a play, and I'll let you say the title of it because I don't want to mispronounce it, make it sound too highfalutin.
It's The Classroom Ain't Enough.
Okay. And let me start with a question which I normally would ask later on, except I want, why did you write the title in this way? Is this a reflection of the play in some way, or?
I wanted something jarring.
Uh-huh.
I think the perception of inner city youth in public school is kind of off. So for me to spell it correctly, I thought just didn't scream to what I was trying to broadcast. And I spelt enough incorrectly because that's how it's spelled in Sean Gay's play for Color Girls, who was considered suicide when the rainbow isn't enough.
Mm-hmm.
To pay homage to the fact that this writer had inspired me so much.
Okay. Now, can you just give us just a brief sentence or two idea of what the play is about and why it might? Because here in the press release, it's referred to as unique. Just tell us whatever you want to tell us about it.
I mean, for me, it was essential that I wrote something that allowed actors to play roles where their complex identities are not the story. I wanted them to be the story, so an audience can see the spirit of who they are and not only see their essence, but their experience. And in the play for Color Girls, I feel the author does that extremely well. And it's a choreo poem, so it includes things that are very important to our culture, which is poetry, dance, music.
Mm-hmm.
So I want the audience to know that they're going to come into a soundful, beautiful experience that is more than just the classic literature on the page.
Yeah. Well, I'm really, really looking forward to watching this performance. Now, I understand that this play, The Classroom Ain't Enough, Wait a minute, am I leaving out something?
Nope,
yeah, I guess that's it. Classroom ain't enough. It's just, it's written in big letters at the top, and I thought it was, now there it looks shorter. Okay, the classroom ain't enough is based on your experiences as a teacher and as a student.
Mm-hmm.
How are they different in any important way?
Different as in how?
I mean, your experience as a teacher and your experience as a student. I mean, are they different in ways that you may not have expected when you started teaching? Or are they different because it's not what you've been led to believe? Or different because they're different from the experience of other groups that may have a different experience?
I think it was very different for me personally. I think being in a space where I didn't have control or agency to being the person who can provide that agency.
Is this as a teacher or as a student?
As a student, I didn't feel like I had the agency. I definitely didn't have parental support, which is what you really needed to get the opportunities you wanted. I'm still upset about this, and rest in peace for my father. Mm-hmm. But my parents blocked me from taking AP classes and forced me to go into vocational education.
Oh.
Which is why it took me so much longer to graduate from college than most.
Yeah.
Because I spent most of my education building computers. And then I get an academic scholarship to go to Central Michigan University, and all my classmates have taken all these college level classes already. And I had none of them.
Yeah. Did you understand why they didn't want you to take the advanced classes?
I mean, I don't think my parents had faith that I could graduate from college, that I had what it took.
Uh-huh.
I just think they just didn't have the knowledge, mm-hmm. or they saw me as someone who could also provide to the household. And if I didn't go far away, I would do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I really don't know. I should ask my mother when she comes to see the play.
Yeah,
why it was so important for them to place me in vocational education.
Yeah. Now the Maria Damon, the artistic director of Broom Street Theater, describes your play as experimental and emotional, and she also says it's really fun to read. Do you have an idea why it's emotional and why it's particularly why it's experimental? What makes experimental play? Because we hear this all the time now, and we have about 35 seconds. So just take the experimental part.
I think it's experimental because it's a choreo poem and it's not taught. Uh-huh. They're not teaching Shine Gay to everyone.
Oh, yeah.
We're not in that classical canon.
Mm.
And I think modeling something like that instead of modeling something off of Shakespeare is seen as weird to some people, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Because they don't have common experience. I think for people who have gone to Vagina Monologues and have seen this format before, it's not experimental.
Okay.
But for, you know, a theater company that does community theater, that runs it mostly off of volunteers, they're not coming across plays like this that often.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Charles Payne, for being with us tonight. And I must tell our listeners that next week, we'll have the director of the play as well as some of the actors here to talk with us and actually entertain us a little bit. So please join us next week for the continuation of this program on The Classroom Ain't Enough. And we'll see you again next week right here at the same place. Good night.
You've been listening to Radio Literature, a weekly program on WORT 89.9 FM Madison. We are listener-sponsored community radio. Join us again next Thursday at 7:30 for more features of local, national, and international interest. WORT Madison.
Hi there, this is Steve Hackett. You're listening to Psychoacoustics on Hi there, this is Steve Hackett. You're listening to Psychoacoustics on WORT.
Perfect. Oh, thank you so much. All right, well, actually, you're going to hear a whole lot more from Steve Hackett. Steve Hackett Band will be in town a week from tonight. The famous, wonderful, fantastic guitarist from Genesis graciously gave us an exclusive interview, so do stay tuned. Until then, we're going to hear some more. We're going to start with some wonderful Genesis music, and we'll be hearing Steve Hackett's brand new solo album as well. It's a great interview. You're not going to hear it anywhere else. It's the first time you're going to hear it tonight. So if you're a prog rock fan at all, tell your friends, tune in, stay tuned, stay with us, check it out on the website later on, and enjoy wonderful music of Genesis and Steve Hackett here on WORT. Psychoacoustics is the radio show.